It's Thursday, October 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama apologizes to the international medical charity that operates the hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, which sustained a deadly airstrike last weekend.
The president, first off, apologized without really any sort of a holding back on what was, by everyone's estimation, a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Approval for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Pact is expected to be easier in Asia than in the U.S., and a new film explores the life of Apple founder Steve Jobs. It's all ahead. President Obama Wednesday took the extraordinary step of phoning the head of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, also known as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, to apologize for a U.S. airstrike on a hospital in embattled Kunduz, Afghanistan, Saturday. The bombing killed 22 patients and MSF staff. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says Mr. Obama told Joanne Liu there would be a thorough accounting of the facts and, if necessary, changes made to avoid future such incidents.
The president assured Dr. Liu that the Department of Defense investigation currently underway would provide a transparent, thorough, and objective accounting of the facts and circumstances of the incident, and that, if necessary, the president would implement changes that would make tragedies like this one less likely to occur in the future. After completing that call, the president telephoned Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to express his condolences for the innocent loss of life in that incident. The president commended the bravery of Afghan National Defense and Security Forces in securing Kunduz, and noted that he looked forward to continuing to work closely with President Ghani and the Afghan government to support their efforts to provide security for the Afghan people.
Earnest says the phone call underscores the president's view that when the U.S. makes a mistake, it is honest about it, owns up to it, apologizes, and tried to do better. But with separate U.S., NATO, and Afghan investigations underway, he declined to say whether the president backs the demand by Doctors Without Borders for an independent investigation of the October 3rd attack. Jason Cohn is MSF's executive director.
The facts and circumstances of this attack must be investigated independently and impartially, particularly given the inconsistencies in the U.S. and Afghan accounts of what happened over recent days. We cannot rely only on internal military investigations by the U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces. Today, we've announced that we're seeking an investigation into the Kunduz attack by the International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission. This commission was established in additional protocols of the Geneva Conventions, and is the only permanent body set up specifically to investigate violations of international humanitarian law. Though this body has existed since 1991, the commission has not yet been used. It requires one of the 76 signatory states to sponsor an inquiry. Governments up to now have never activated the commission. The tool exists, and it is time that it is activated for this purpose.
Cohn says his group has called on President Obama to consent to the fact-finding commission. Doing so, he says, will send a powerful signal of the U.S. government's commitment to and respect for international humanitarian law. RAND Corporation's South Asia analyst Jonah Blank tells VOA's Victor Beatty the president's phone call was an important gesture.
The president, first off, apologized without really any sort of a holding back on what was, by everyone's estimation, a terrible, terrible tragedy that affected Médecins Sans Frontières, one of the most praiseworthy NGOs working in the world today, killing 22 people, staff and patients. So I think that really sent a powerful message that even before an investigation determines all of the facts, the president was right to call him to apologize, because these were U.S. aircraft, U.S. munitions.
The medical charity is pressing its demand for an international commission to investigate what it says amounts to a war crime. Do you think the president's call was meant to forestall that?
I don't think it really had a political meaning as much as a messaging of acknowledging responsibility for the tragedy and wanting to get out ahead of the cycle of blame. I think that the president was really trying to say, we're going to determine accountability. We're going to figure out what happened. But before we even do that, let's get right out and say, This was a terrible tragedy that was caused by American troops and American munitions. So let's just get right out and apologize for something that everyone acknowledges was just a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Well, the Doctors Without Borders group says an independent commission's inquiry would gather facts and evidence from the U.S., NATO, and Afghanistan, testimony from staff and patients who survived the attack. Only then would it consider whether to bring criminal charges for loss of life and partial destruction of its hospital. Does that open up U.S. military personnel to prosecution?
I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to get beyond my brief. Médecins Sans Frontières is quite understandably furious about this. Any organization would be if their people had been killed in a fact that never should have happened. But right now, by all indications, at least as I read the evidence, this was a mistake rather than a deliberate action. Until we have some evidence to show that it was a deliberate action and that the U.S. won't hold its personnel accountable, then in my view, it's premature to discredit that process. If I were working for Doctors Without Borders, though, I would certainly have a more skeptical view of things.
Well, Jonah, will this tragedy prompt a change in rules of engagement?
I'm not sure that it really is going to prompt a change because the rules of engagement in place already prohibit any kind of attack on a hospital and really are quite stringent about the measures that are needed in order to engage an enemy or a suspected enemy. I think that the investigation is going to try to figure out why were these rules that are already in place clearly not followed.
Jonah Blank says Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has been relatively quiet about the attack because he knows it was requested by Afghan security forces and he understands the inherent risks involved. Blank says while such events must be minimized and those found guilty of wrongdoing held to account, tragic accidents and war are inextricably linked. Well, for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Susan Yockey. So, Susan, what is the reaction to this airstrike in Kunduz?
Hi, Sarah. The New York Times writes, Mr. Obama's personal expression of regret in a telephone call from the Oval Office appeared to do little to satisfy the leader of the doctors group, who issued a terse statement saying the president's apology had been received.
We seem to be having some technical problems at the moment. We will get back to that report in a while. In other news, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the most expansive trade agreement in history, is being hailed among its dozen member governments for unifying a market encompassing 40% of the global economy with $30 trillion total output. But the pact's implementation is not yet assured. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok looks at the legislative hurdles it still must clear.
After the secrecy of the negotiating process, politicians, special interest groups, and the public in the 12 TPP countries will soon get to analyze the details when the entire document is published. Some are going to see items they do not like, and that will increase the pressure on legislators, weighing whether to support it. If all of the participating countries do not ratify it within 2 years, then six original signatories, which account for 85% of the bloc's gross domestic product, must ratify it. The math means approval by the United States is essential, along with either Canada or Japan. Already, there is considerable opposition from some powerful U.S. senators, including those in President Obama's Democratic Party. Former Secretary of State and now Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is among those opposing the TPP. Some observers predict that approval, if it occurs, is not likely until after the U.S. presidential elections in November of next year. Deborah Elms, a TPP proponent, is the executive director of the Asia Trade Center.
I could imagine that if the U.S. cannot or will not or is unable to implement the agreement, that the others might decide to move ahead anyway and basically do a new version of this agreement without the United States.
In Malaysia, opposition lawmaker Charles Santiago has criticized the TPP as one of the most dangerous trade pacts when it comes to access to affordable medicine, particularly in the developing world. He tells VOA that Malaysia's government has promised to follow the lead of the parliament's consensus, but it has the power to approve the pact, even if the majority of lawmakers oppose it.
They could, because technically the Constitution allows the cabinet to sign on to any trade agreement, which they have done all this while. But because of the pressure from civil society, from trade unions, from professional groups, including small and medium industries, I think the government said, look, we need a buy-in. And if Parliament doesn't support the idea of this agreement, then we will not support it.
In Vietnam, one of the biggest beneficiaries from the Pacific Accord, the TPP is expected to sail through easily, according to Dinh Xuân Thảo, chairman of the legislature's research institute. He says legislators received information about it during the negotiation process, and all are united in that regard, so there should be no hurdles in approving it. But there is concern about the rights of state-sanctioned labor unions in Vietnam. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Okay, now we go back to International Edition's Susan Yaki, who is going to be joining us to look at reaction on social media to the airstrike on Kunduz, Afghanistan, and President Obama's apology about it.
Thank you, Sarah. The New York Times writes Mr. Obama's personal expression of regret in a telephone call from the Oval Office appeared to do little to satisfy the leader of the doctors group, who issued a terse statement saying the president's apology had been received. It notes that direct presidential apologies to victims of American actions abroad are rare but not unheard of. The Times reports that in 2012, Mr. Obama wrote a letter of apology to President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan after several copies of the Quran were burned by American military personnel, leading to violent protests across that country. Tony at Oak Round writes, I bet Obama and some of the White House press office spin people think his apology for the MSF bombing in Kunduz is the end of the matter. Margaret Kimberly writes, keep the pressure on Obama. His apology is a joke, she calls it. Dougie's Daily Digest calls Obama's apology heartfelt. Leanne Gettler's blog says it took him long enough, but Barack Obama has finally apologized. The site compares the Kunduz attack to Russian activity in Syria, saying, one thing for sure, Barack Obama offered a statement of condolence to the victims while promising to get to the truth of what happened. The relatives of Syrian civilians killed by Russian jets will have to wait a lot longer before they hear anything similar from President Putin.
Well, Susan, what else is trending?
Well, on Facebook today, hashtag Don't Steal Possible says more than 18,000 hold stand for school equality rally in Brooklyn. It says the rally, attended by parents, kids, and charter school advocates in Brooklyn, was planned by Families for Excellent Schools, and Jennifer Hudson performed at the event. And today is apparently National Poetry Day, and the RHS writes, roses are red, violets are blue, ivy is green, dahlias can be range in many colors. This poem has run out of steam. I thought that was kind of cute. You can add your own poem if you like at hashtag National Poetry Day. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yaki. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The 2015 Nobel Science Prizes were announced this week in Sweden. William Campbell and Satoshi Omura share one half of this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work in finding a unique method to fight infections caused by roundworm parasites. Yu-Yu Tu was awarded the other half of the prize for her discoveries that may lead to an innovative therapy against malaria. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics goes to Takaki Kajita and Arthur MacDonald for their research on atomic particles called neutrinos. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Tomas Lindahl, Paul Modrich, and Aziz Sankar for their work on DNA repair, which could lead to the development of new cancer treatments. This year's Nobel Prizes will be awarded on December 10th in a ceremony that will be held in Stockholm, Sweden. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about a new film that looks at the life of Apple founder Steve Jobs. One of the most anticipated outcomes of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent state visit to the U.S. was an agreement between the two countries to cooperate more closely on cybersecurity and put a halt to economic espionage online. Well, some analysts are questioning whether the deal actually can deliver what it promises. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers the cyber world for us and joins me now. Well, Doug, you've written a piece which is on voanews.com.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what are some of the concerns by analysts about this?
Well, it all looked great when it was announced, right? So here we are on the lawn of the White House. There's President Barack Obama, President Xi Jinping of China, and they're both talking about the need to cooperate in terms of improving cybersecurity, promising not to engage in economic espionage with one another. The president, President Obama, said this is real progress, was his quote when he said of it. But then analysts started actually looking at this agreement. It's actually called a common understanding officially. And they found that there's really not a lot of there. There seems to be a lot of kind of happy talk almost about the need to improve cybersecurity. But what's completely lacking is any sense of what cybersecurity means for both nations, what sort of enforcement mechanisms were agreed upon, if any, and really what should be done if one side crosses a line.
Well, apparently the U.S. and China have different views of cybersecurity.
I think very different views, and I'm certainly not alone. Many analysts we've spoke with over the years have stated that. So, for example, in the West, and particularly in the United States, cybersecurity generally refers to hackers, to network intrusions, to people putting malware and viruses and really kind of fouling up network computer systems. But in China, generally, cybersecurity has a much broader meaning. Now, remember, of course, in China, everything serves the state and the party, the Communist Party there. So cyber serves the state. So if it comes to perhaps intellectual property that was maybe stolen from another country, from another corporation, but it's going to help Chinese industry, well, that's seen as benefiting the nation. So in China's worldview, that's not a violation of cybersecurity.
And there's also difficulty in regards to attribution or proving.
Right. Well, this is a classic problem in cyber. If you're going to say, well, we're going to retaliate in some way, you have to be able to prove to the world publicly that a certain company or a certain government was behind any particular hack or data theft. Now, that's extremely difficult. It's not impossible, but it's extremely difficult. And complicating matters is if a government, say the United States could say, well, you know, we're concerned that the Chinese government may be, you know, assisting in some of these cyber thefts. That's one thing. But if the U.S. government were to come out publicly and lay out, here's the information and here's the data that proves so-and-so in the Chinese government is behind this, that's going to lay bare a whole lot of U.S. intelligence assets. And once you do that, that's like, you know, sort of shining a light on spies and saying, well, that person's gone and that's done now. So governments are very reluctant, I think, to really officially point the finger at each other. Instead, what we have are these sort of vague accusations back and forth that don't really seem to prove anything or lead to anything.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Doug. That is International Edition's Doug Bernard. This is International Edition. A new film looks at the life of the late Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, the mercurial innovator who helped to revolutionize the modern world. The movie features Oscar-winning writer Aaron Sorkin's take on the life of the man who made iPad, iPhone, and iMac part of the language forever. International Edition's David Byrd has more.
People often seem to have one of two opinions about Steve Jobs. Either they love him and think he was a genius, or they despise him as an abusive egomaniac. But Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin has walked between these two extremes with his treatment of the script of Steve Jobs.
What if the computer was a beautiful object? Something you want to look at and have in your home? And what if, instead of it being in the right hands, it was in everyone's hands?
We'd be talking about the most tectonic shift in the status quo since
ever.
Sorkin worked off Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, but didn't want to do an episode-by-episode treatment of Jobs' life. He presents the audience with the Apple co-founder in three acts, in 1984, in 1988, and again in 1998. Sorkin says that presenting the story in three acts lets the audience glimpse some of the man behind the public persona.
The whole movie is just three scenes, all of them in real time. Real time, of course, means 30 minutes for you in the audience. It's the same as 30 minutes for a character on screen. And explore these points of conflict that Steve had in his life, and that way you get to know him, and they're all set backstage in the minutes leading up to one of his big product launches.
The first act is when Jobs is about to launch the Apple Macintosh. The second is in 1998, when Jobs has been forced out of Apple and has created a computer that will ultimately fail. The third act is in 1998, with him back at Apple ready to launch the iMac. Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender plays the title role and says that he had no problem with the way Sorkin decided to stage the story.
No, I mean, it was a luxury, a massive luxury, and a necessity, really, to have those 2 weeks in between each act. So we had the 2 weeks, start act one, finished that, took 2 weeks rehearsal, and then same thing for act two, same thing for act three. It was a great help, you know, just in terms of dealing with the volume of lines.
Fassbender says he didn't try to find out too much about Steve Jobs outside of Sorkin's script.
This is not a biopic, it's a dramatization, and I just tried to, you know, honor the script and follow Danny's direction, and just, you know, also in full respect to Mr. Jobs, you know, honor the man himself.
Director Danny Boyle says he was impressed with Fassbender's characterization and discipline. Boyle says he never saw the actor look at a script or asked for a line. He just inhabited the character.
He's an actor. He's an uncompromising actor, really. So when the studio go, can he be a bit more, can I have a bit more likability in this scene? Michael's not going to listen to that. He is an intensely truthful and uncompromising actor. And there's something very Jobsian about that. Lack of compromise, that drive to the vision.
Kate Winslet plays Jobs' confidant Joanna Hoffman. Seth Rogen plays Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Jeff Daniels stars as John Sculley, the CEO of Apple from 1983 to 1993. Katherine Waterston plays Chris Ann Brennan, Jobs' high school girlfriend and the mother of his first child. Steve Jobs opens nationwide in U.S. theaters October 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In too many countries around the world, criminals have built great empires on laundered funds to infiltrate and corrupt government institutions. In this shadowy illegal economy, said David Luna of the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, traffickers and narcotics kingpins act as CEOs and venture capitalists while they build their empires of destruction. These illicit activities have taken over a significant chunk of the world economy. According to various international organizations, the illegal economy accounts for 8 to 15% of the world gross domestic product, and in many developing countries, it may account for higher percentages in their economies. The World Trade Organization estimates that the value of counterfeit and pirated goods alone is equivalent to some 7% of the world's merchandise. This darker side of global trade is thriving with hundreds of billions of dollars in illicit commerce that includes trafficking in narcotics, persons, and endangered wildlife, among other goods and commodities. Simply put, illicit trade is an obstacle to shared prosperity by breeding corruption and siphoning capital and human resources away from legitimate economic activity. The best way to combat illegal trade is through collective action. This includes strengthening cross-border cooperation to tackle illicit commerce and help communities to seize the benefits of open trade to achieve sustainable development and security. Country implementation of the WTO's Trade Facilitation Agreement will play a critical role in this process. The United States will continue to enhance international cooperation with key partners to combat the lethal nexus of organized crime, illicit trade, corruption, and money laundering, and to protect communities from the violence, harm, and exploitation brought about by transnational networks. The U.S. will do this by enhancing its efforts to break their corruptive power, attacking their financial underpinnings, following the money and stripping them of their illicit wealth, and severing their access to the financial system. At a time when global risks are growing and converging, the international community must come together and build its own network to stand up to and defeat the dark world of illicit trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.